This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The United States is working with Iraqi exiles, tribal sheiks, Kurds, and Shiite clerics to organize a new democratic government. My guest Fareed Zakaria has written a new book that explains why creating a democracy is much more difficult than just organizing elections. Democracy, he says, has its dark side. Elections can give legitimacy to dictators. Elections can give the majority ethnic group the power to tyrannize the minority. Zakaria's new book is called The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. Zakaria is the editor of Newsweek International and is a columnist for the domestic edition of Newsweek. He's also a panelist on the ABC Sunday morning program This Week. In The Future of Freedom, Zakaria says that democracy isn't synonymous with liberty. I asked him to elaborate on that.
Well, if you think about what we mean by democracy in America, sure, we mean the elections, but in some ways the heart of American democracy is things like the Bill of Rights, which, if one thinks about it, is a limitation on the powers of democratically elected majorities. What the Bill of Rights is saying is no matter what the majority wants, these rights cannot be abridged. The Supreme Court, 9 unelected men and women are really the most powerful force within the American government. So what I point out in the book is that the development of what I call constitutional liberalism, the rule of law, the separation of powers, the creation of property rights and such, all these bundle of things, has really gone on historically well before elections. And we shouldn't forget that you can very easily find in a place like Iraq that you've gotten elections, but you haven't gotten all these other things that really are the inner stuffing of democracy.
And that's part of what you mean when you use the word illiberal democracy. Describe a little bit more what you mean by that term.
Well, I was looking around the world in the 1990s and seeing all these elections taking place in far-flung places like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, and 42 of 48 African countries held elections in the 1990s. And I noticed we weren't getting what we thought we would get. And so I've realized that what we in the West call democracy is really liberal democracy, democracy plus all these rights and rules of law. If you just have elections without that background, what you get is not liberal democracy, but illiberal democracy, a democracy where the elected dictator, majority party, systematically abuses human rights, systematically oppresses minorities. And this pattern is dismayingly common. You see it in many, many parts of the Third World, where quick transitions to democracy have gone very badly awry.
And do you think that's partially because the elections are rigged, that there's especially a one-party system or a one-candidate system, or people suspect they'll be punished if they don't vote for the right person? Or do you think that people willingly say, this is the guy we want, he's going to be a dictator, that's what we want?
It's a very good question. There's some aspect of it is certainly elections that are not completely free and fair, where parties maneuver to gain advantages. But a lot of it is the fact that in immature political systems, and I mean immature not in a derogatory sense, just young political systems, in young political systems, without a background in multi-ethnic groups and civic associations, when people vote, they vote on the basis of the most raw characteristics, race or ethnicity or some other kind of group, or they vote for a strong man. So you see that in Latin America. You see that in Russia, where Putin has been very popular even while he has prosecuted a bloody war in Chechnya, intimidated the free media into almost total silence, persecuted his political opponents, fired most of the regional governors he didn't like. And he's one of the success stories, I mean, compared with some of the African and Central Asian cases where the elections really just led to pure dictatorships.
Well, let's get to Iraq. When the Bush administration says we're going to create a democracy in Iraq, what model do you think they're considering?
Well, they keep saying that they have no model and that it's up to the Iraqis to decide, which is, I think, the right thing. My guess is, looking at Iraq, what they need more than anything else is a federal decentralized model, a model that really involves a lot of power sharing, because Iraq is riven with ethnic and religious differences. You know, we often talk about the German and Japanese transitions to democracy as great successes. And Germany and Japan had many characteristics that made them, in retrospect, quite favorably biased towards this. They were industrializing countries, background of liberty, background of capitalism. But they were also ethnically homogenous, which makes a big difference. Because what happens when you don't have that kind of homogeneity is, look at the former Yugoslavia. Communism crumbles in Yugoslavia, and what comes to the fore are all these ethnic differences, and the elections fuel them because Serbian politicians decide to whip up Serbian nationalism, Croatian politicians decide to whip up Croatian nationalism, and what you end up with is an even more polarized political system. In Iraq, the great danger is if you held elections tomorrow is that Shia politicians would aggressively court the Shia vote, saying we've been persecuted for so many years. Sunni politicians would aggressively court the Sunni vote, saying, look, if you need somebody to protect you, otherwise these guys are going to get us. The Kurds would obviously do the same. And you would end up separating and segregating these communities further, building up group resentments and group grievances. So what you really need is a model that is federal in structure, has power sharing, so that nobody feels excluded. You know, my motto would be for Iraq, to the loser go the spoils. In other words, don't create a system where if you win 49% of the vote, but just miss the majority, you get zero power. There are various models, proportional representation, things like that, where you can give people a stake in the system even if they're a minority.
Well, if we really believe in democracy, then we should establish a system in which people elect their leaders, and we would have to live with the fact that those leaders might not like the United States, and the United States might not look kindly on those leaders. I mean, do you think that that's possible, that even if we postpone elections and kind of create a system in which democracy can really take root and then hold elections, you know, that the outcome still might not be something that would be favorable for the American government?
I'm entirely comfortable with the idea that democracies will be anti-American. Look, most of Europe is at this point anti-American, and they're all democracies, and we live with it, and there's nothing we can do about it and nothing we should do about it. The point I'm making is more for the people of Iraq. If you create a democracy that is merely the shell of elections and that has nothing else in there, you're going to create something that looks more like Venezuela or Iran, a place that systematically abuses human rights, allows all kinds of minority rights to be trampled, does not uphold the rule of law. I don't think it would be a particularly good outcome for Iraqis, but you're absolutely right. If 10 years from now you've had a normal, a well-phased transition to a kind of mature liberal democracy, and anti-American politicians are elected, the United States should absolutely be comfortable with it, should understand it. That's what happened in Turkey. We wanted the use of Turkish bases, and the reason we were unable to get them was Turkish democracy. The government was in favor, but the parliament, looking at opinion polls, voted against it. I think this administration believes very strongly in the idea that when you have power, you should use it. When you have political capital, you should expend it. And I think they see themselves in a position of victory in the war, and therefore being able to cow a country like Syria, and have taken up all these issues with it. I have no doubt that it's essentially true that the Syrians have done some of this. And I think what the administration is doing is trying to, you know, force Syria, using all the power they have in the wake of the war, to stop doing it. The danger here, of course, is we are not going to invade Syria. The United States, whatever people may think, is not a bandit regime. We have no legal basis for a war in Syria. Whatever one may think about the wisdom of having gone to war with Saddam Hussein, the point of fact is that he had been violating UN resolutions, was in breach of the ceasefire of the Gulf War. I think it was a 12-year process of trying to get him to to agree to inspections. None of this is true with Syria. So there's virtually no circumstance I can imagine in which we were to invade Syria. So I would be a little careful with the kinds of threats one makes because, you know, there's a wonderful line of out of an international politics book by Thomas Schelling where he says, in international politics, two things are very expensive. Threats when they fail and promises when they succeed. So if you threaten somebody, just be careful because they might call your bluff. And I'm not sure what we would do to Syria if they called our bluff. We could sanction them, but this is not a country particularly plugged into the world economy that's going to matter.
So you feel confident that what we did in Iraq isn't going to become a model about what the United States will do next in Iran or Syria or North Korea?
Oh, yes. I can't imagine that there is anybody seriously in the administration thinking that. I think there are many people who think they can use this success as a way of kind of bullying and cajoling and cowing some of these regimes into submission. But I don't think that it could be used as a model because in each of those cases, the circumstances are just very different. In North Korea, we really do not have a military option because of the nature of North Korean forces. They could destroy so many South Koreans so quickly. In Iran and Syria, as I say, we just have no legal basis. I mean, we're not going to just invade a country because we don't happen to like them.
You have supported the war in Iraq. I'd like you to compare what you thought of the war before it started with what you think of it now.
Broadly speaking, there was little about the war that surprised me in the sense that I thought it would be relatively easy to do militarily, and I did think that once the war was over, it would look better in retrospect because the regime would be shown to have been very evil. And I think in both those things I've been vindicated. I was stunned by the speed of the collapse and indeed the total ineptness by which Saddam defended his country. I mean, when I went to graduate school, we would have learned that elementary military strategy would have told you that what Saddam should have done is concentrated his forces close to Kuwait. After all, we were bringing in American troops through a keyhole. If he had concentrated his forces and bled us there, it would have been very difficult. He could have then gone on a backward retreat, blowing up the port of Umm Qasr, blowing up the bridges on the Euphrates and Tigris. And he didn't do any of that, which leads me to think that perhaps we did either kill him or incapacitate him very early, because if not, this will go down in the history books as one of the most spectacularly inept defenses of a homeland ever seen.
So what are your concerns about things that can go wrong as the United States tries to help create a democracy in Iraq?
The first thing that can go wrong is the way the United States engages and helps Iraq. I think it is very important that we be there, we stay there. Somebody has to govern the country in the short term. That will be us. And yet, this is going to be called colonialism. It's going to be called imperialism. And for that reason, I've always been a very strong advocate of involving the international community for our own sake, because it will give us a cover. It will internationalize this process so that we're not out there picking which Shia leader is going to rule Nasiriyah and which Kurdish leader is going to rule in the north, that it is done more as a kind of collaborative venture. And so that's the first part. The second thing that can go wrong is, as I say, group politics can get out of control. And the third and most difficult is going to be Iraq's oil. This is generally considered a great blessing because it means that Iraq will be able to pay for its own reconstruction and it will have monies to spend. Vice President Cheney often says this is a great advantage in their building democracy. Well, I don't think so. I think if you look around the world, oil has been a curse, not a blessing. There is, with the exception of Norway, not a single functioning democracy among the oil-rich states of the world.
Was that a function of the oil, or is that a function of something else?
It's essentially a function of the oil. When a country has treasures in its ground, in its soil, when it has natural resource endowments, oil, natural gas, things like that, it means the country doesn't have to go through the hard work of creating a system of laws and policies that generate economic wealth. All you do is you drill into the ground. And so you bypass the whole process of modernization. You know, I call them in the book trust fund states because they're very similar in the sense that they have access to unearned income, large amounts of unearned income, so they don't have to go through the more difficult and painful job of producing wealth. If you look at East Asia, the countries that have grown fastest in the last 35 years, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, what is striking about these countries is that they have virtually no natural resources of any kind. So if those countries needed to get rich, they had to create real industries, and they had to produce products that had a real demand, and they had to educate their workforce. There was this whole process of modernization that took place for economic reasons, but that had political benefits. If you look at Nigeria, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, the oil-rich states of the world, you see none of that happening. Illiteracy rates in a country like Saudi Arabia are still astonishingly high, 50% by some counts, in a country that is, one of the richest countries in the world. So you have the wealth, but it ends up being globbed onto an unmodernized, almost feudal social system. And that, I think, is at the heart of the problem.
So in the countries you're talking about, the oil industry is owned by the people at the very top, the people who rule the country. They can choose to share some of that wealth with the people of the country, but that's, at their discretion. They could modernize the country with the wealth from the oil, but it's at their discretion, and it may or may not involve anybody else in the country.
Precisely. There's an enormous incentive to corruption, and if it's not the state that owns it, it's a few oil barons who own it. If you look at what happened in Russia, they quote-unquote privatized it, but it really meant that they privatized it in the sense that Boris Yeltsin's five best friends got very large state assets for fire sale prices. Natural resources like oil have a distorting effect in almost all cases. It really takes very hard work to make sure they don't. Of course, it can be done. Even some trust fund kids turn out all right.
In your book, you say that, Woodrow Wilson said we had to make the world safe for democracy. And now what we have to do is make democracy safe for the world. What do you mean by that?
I'm a great fan of democracy, and I think it is the best form of government. I think it has produced wonderful, miraculous changes around the world. But I do think it has certain downsides. It has certain tendencies that you have to worry about. And if we don't worry about them, my real fear is that what will happen is that democracy will get discredited, that democracy will become a means for ethnic groups to oppress other ethnic groups. It will become a means for dictators to get elected and then ratify their elections. It will become a means for other kinds of dysfunction. So what I want to do is to save democracy from its downsides, to repair and restore that older conception of democracy in which we worried as much about the constitutional aspects of it, the institutions of democracy, as about just the elections. There's this wonderful line that the graduates of the Harvard Law School are told. I think it's on their diplomas when they're graduate, and it says, "Please remember that law is the wise restraints that make men free." And I think that's the part I want to recover, the sense that there have to be some restraints and guides within democracy. Otherwise, you create a system that is going to get very dysfunctional. And my real fear when you have periods of crisis is that people will start blaming democracy for the problems. My hope is to really save democracy from itself.
Fareed Zakaria, you grew up in India, which had been a British colony. Now, by the time you were born, it was no longer a British colony. What were some of the good and bad leftover effects from the British era?
Well, the bad effects are easy to catalog because there were ones that were played up in nationalist literature quite a lot. But by and large, you had a lot of racism. You had institutionalized abuse of power. You had segregation. You had whites-only clubs. There used to be clubs in Bombay where it would say Indians and dogs cannot enter, that kind of thing. And so in many ways, it was a very demeaning kind of a legacy for Indians. And that's why there's so much nationalism in so many parts of the Third World, you know, that were once colonies. But I think one has to look back in retrospect and also notice something. A professor of political science in 1983 pointed out that every functioning democracy in the Third World at that time was a former British colony. Now, it's changed a little since then, but still the overwhelming number of developing world democracies are former British colonies. I think the reason for that is, as I describe in my book, that the British also left a legacy of institutions. They didn't give India any democracy, but they did give it the rule of law. They did give it private property. They did give it a court system, a commercial system, and things like that. And it turned out that when India went democratic, this was a very useful edifice and foundation to build on. So in that sense, British rule in India has been a mixed blessing. No question one is better off without being ruled by an imperial power. But if you had to be ruled by somebody, it turns out the British were a whole lot better than some of the others.
What were some of the attitudes you grew up with about the British and about the West in general?
Oh, there was a real love-hate in India because, by and large, the Indian elite, and I mean by that English-speaking, urban, you know, middle class, were in many ways westernized and anglicized in the sense that they learned a lot about the world through their contact with these institutions that England had built. But on the other hand, they had often felt humiliated by the British, and they had felt that they were second-class citizens. So, you know, it's best seen in a man like Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, who was a British-trained barrister, went to Harrow and Cambridge, and, you know, could quote Shakespeare and Keats with the best of them. But was in many ways a very fierce Indian nationalist and was quite anti-British in his foreign policy. And that's something you see often in the Third World, where a modernizer at home, a westernizer at home, might end up having an anti-Western foreign policy. It's true of Turkey as well, by the way. The Kemal Atatürk, who everyone looks at as the great modernizer of the Islamic world, you know, the guy who created an Islamic modern state, Turkey, was simultaneously fighting the Western powers. He fought wars against the West while he westernized at home.
Religion was such a divisive issue in India that after India got its independence, India was partitioned into Muslim, primarily Muslim Pakistan and primarily Hindu India. Did you grow up with a sense that religion is a very divisive part of identity?
I grew up with the feeling that religion was something that had to be handled very carefully because it could tear the country apart. My father was a politician who had made the decision not to go to Pakistan when India was partitioned because he wanted to be part of an experiment in secular democracy, not an experiment in religious nationalism. And he's very, very pro-Indian, pro-secular in that sense. And so I grew up with that worldview. And it's been very sad to watch India over the last 25 years become much less secular than it was, become much less tolerant, not just toward Muslims. The rise of Hindu nationalism has mostly been directed at Muslims, but it's also been directed at Christians. In the last 4 years, there have been more Christians killed in religious violence in India than in the previous 40 years. And this is because when you have raw contests for power, politicians will often appeal to the worst angels in human beings. And what Hindu fundamentalists have been doing is appealing to the most base instincts of hardcore Hindu voters, which are anti-Muslim, anti-Christian. And it's been very, very sad to watch this fragile experiment with secular democracy get corroded. I mean, India is still a wonderful country, but it's, in my mind at least, it has certainly tarnished its reputation with all this religious violence.
Since religion was such a divisive, and it remains such a divisive issue in India, and since your father was dedicated to having a secular government that bridged different religions, what was it like for you coming to the United States and seeing fundamentalist Christianity play a significant part in the American political scene?
Well, when I came to America, I was struck by how differently diversity was handled in America than in India. In India, you couldn't really have assimilation because these communities, Hindus and Muslims, but even other ethnic and tribal communities, were just different and didn't want to assimilate. What in India one was trying to do was to create tolerance. In America, the attempt is more at assimilation and a very successful attempt, by and large, I think. The Christian right, of course, bothers me, particularly now that it has gone on this sort of anti-Muslim tirade. But what I've been struck by is the degree to which they have really not been able to have an effect on the mainstream culture of the United States, which is still very tolerant and very open. What they have had an effect on is the political process, because they are well-organized, fanatical, and it's one of the things I talk about in the book when I turn to American democracy, is that the way in which America has democratized its system has left itself prey to these small fanatical interest groups. And so I worry about them more politically than in a kind of broader social and cultural sense.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Fareed Zakaria is the author of the new book, The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad. He's the editor of Newsweek International and a panelist on the ABC Sunday morning program, This Week.